Okay, welcome to another edition of Behind the Radio. It's been quite a while since we did one, but today's is focusing on Season 2 of Beyond Traditional Recognition, our semi-professional science fiction anthology series. With me today I've got...
Mike Hugh, Vitold Tietzer, the script editor and creator of Beyond Traditional Recognition.
Yes, and I think we did a very similar gag on the start of the last Beyond Traditional Recognition where you pretended you didn't hear my cue.
It's a gag? I didn't hear your cue.
Oh, okay, fair enough. So, Vitol, we've, at the point of recording, we've just finished all of Season 1 in terms of releasing it, so all of Season 1 of Beyond is fully released and available to purchase. Mm. What are your sort of thoughts upon reflecting on how we went with Season 1?
I think... Because it was our first season, it was a bit on the rough and ready side, but I certainly think that it's got a lot of appeal to it. And I mean, it's one of those things of you look back and you think, well, we do better stuff now, but hey, it was still pretty good all the same, and it was certainly good for what we could manage. I think there was a nice bit of variety to it. We got a lot of different story styles happening there, and we certainly, I think, got a lot of good acting, good post-production, some very nice music from Robert Warnock, and I think as a set of six episodes, it's a good little 3-hour package of all sorts of science fiction.
But between Season 1 and Season 2, the world of Beyond Traditional Recognition, as you might have mentioned just before, had quite a lot of expansion occur with with a stage production based around the idea of Beyond Traditional Recognition occurring in August 2002, and then in December 2002 with the release of BTR Publishing's first paperback short story collection, once again based around Beyond Traditional Recognition. Do you think that these were both great ways to expand upon what we'd managed with the audio series, and are they sort of ways that you'd like to see the series continue to expand and improve on in the future?
I think that was certainly a good start, although you make it sound so long ago. It feels like it was just around the corner, but can't believe it's nearly a year and a half now for the
That's
play.
That's how quickly we work here, I think. We just seem to do so much.
Yeah. No, I think sort of taking it to the next level with a stage play was a very interesting idea, and although I think everyone would have been happier had we had the opportunity to finally stage the completely original play that we were hoping to run in its entirety, I do somewhat like the mix of a new play and an adaptation of an old one, especially as the new play has elements from a past Beyond audio play. I'm a big fan of sort of multimedia expansion and so on, and I think it was a nice tread onto the boards and a nice way to move away from just audio, and certainly a relatively inexpensive way to visualize the series. The anthology, however, I'm immensely proud of. I think we got a good range of stories there, and the finished product turned out very nicely. We got some great artwork from Brian Jordan, was it?
Yes, that's right. Darren Jordan's father, who also works on the Eclectica Press stories like Dogs and Tales of Strangor.
That's right. So there was a very nice cover on that, and
very different to how we imagined it, I believe we both commented at the time.
I think so.
It was more colourful than we'd ever thought it would be.
But I think it's safe to say it's grown on us.
Yes.
And it's definitely eye-catching, especially with all the eyes that have been caught in the picture.
Yes.
If anyone gets a chance to have a look at a copy, you'll know exactly what I mean.
Available now from BTR Productions.
That's right. But I thought the stories came together quite nicely. I like that we had a linking theme, and I do like, although I'm happy to admit that it was initially one of these fortuitous accidents, that we managed to get the equivalent of a double-length two-parter in there, as we tend to do with our audio seasons as well. It was a nice bit of symmetry there, and a good little story from Darren as well.
Yeah,
also, I'm led to believe.
Oh, what, you haven't read it?
Shh!
You were the editor. Anyway, moving along...
Yes.
with season one well and truly behind us, and having learnt quite a bit from that, and having done a stage play based around season one of Beyond Traditional Recognition, and then the anthology, we hurtled straight into season two, which wasn't always a certainty, was it? We were sort of testing the water with season one.
That's right.
To make sure, and because we had such a good reception from it, I mean, obviously it didn't sell as well as we'd hoped, in terms of actual grassroots CD sales. They haven't been as high as we were hoping, but then again, given that we'd never sold anything before, I mean, it was safe to say that selling any discs was
absolutely
better than nothing. And so
my thoughts exactly.
And also I think from my own perspective, what we could have improved upon was the marketing side of things for season one, which I think that's the biggest thing I've learned, is how to successfully market the product. Can't just rely on internet forums.
That's right. And you can't just rely on knowing that the product is good. I mean, you can have absolute certainty that you've got a surefire hit there, but if no one's heard of it, then it's not going to sell. Simple as that.
But season two, we're thought what we might do is another, similar to what we did with the last documentary, Behind the Radio, on the series, was go through each of the six stories. The season is, once again, the same format, six 25-minute episodes, with a two-parter opening the season, followed by four individual episodes. So I thought it might be nice if we could run through the six episodes again, just to give people a bit of a taste for what they can expect from season two.
Fair enough.
Opening it is, as I said, the two-part story, The Alien Factor, by Your Good Self. Now, this has an interesting production gestation period.
Certainly
keep
does.
It succinctly, but could you just tell everyone a very basic skeletal rundown of the
I will
the
certainly
alien
try
factor.
My best, yes. Well, actually, it's interesting that we're recording this at the moment, because this year is the 10th anniversary of my having created The Alien Factor, so that just goes to show how much material we have to condense down to 30 seconds of chat.
Yeah.
It was a concept that I came up with 10 years ago, as I say, which has been developing and mutating over the years. And I think about 3 or 4 years ago, when we were starting to look into coming up with an original series instead of just working on our Doctor Who's, I put forward the notion of The Alien Factor simply because, well, there was a series I'd done planning on it. It was in a way ready to roll, but unfortunately it looked a bit daunting logistically. So along came Beyond, and eventually we thought, well, if we can sort of nut down the pilot into a decent shape for a two-part, completely standalone play with no production excesses, then it might be worth a go. And well, that's obviously what we've done, and I'm happy to say that it's opening our second season. Generally, a bit of a plot brief.
Yeah.
Well, it focuses on an organisation called the... I hope you can help me out with this acronym, Matthew.
SCPIS.
Since you've included it in a short story of yours recently.
The Special Covert Preternatural
Investigative Sector.
That's the one,
yes. They're sort of a... Black ops kind of military organization that basically their remit is to look at anything that the government or the military wants kept secret from the public, which in the world of The Alien Factor, of course, looks at various supernatural elements, particularly extraterrestrials. They have two issues to deal with on this particular occasion. One is the possibility of a crashed UFO somewhere in rural Australia, and the other one is the possibility of a recently arrived alien who seems to have very little memory of her past, and of course they're not entirely sure whether she's the genuine article. Is she just hoaxing? Is she a freak genetic aberration, or is she genuinely from another planet?
Certainly a lot to think about there, and I know that having heard the finished product, it's the entire finished product with music and sound effects. I know as a producer I'm really impressed with every aspect of from the writing to the acting to the post-production, the music. I think everything sort of gelled together, and I think this is certainly going to be a special release and a worthy form of tribute to...
What on earth is that?
It's my phone. I'll cut this bit out, obviously. Okay. And a worthy form of tribute to the original, the 10 years' worth of work that you've done on the series. So in terms of Volume 5, because I think we don't need to talk much about the Alien Factor, because remember that we've also got the video documentary
that is
online,
correct,
which details with a lot of the production of the actual material that's on the CD.
Mm-hmm. It even offers a visual version of the trailer, I'm happy to say.
Now, in terms of the Volume 5, which is currently has been recorded and is in the middle of post-production, we have two stories.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is from returning writer Peter Grahan,
yes,
who, if you recall, wrote the Dark Guardian in Season 1.
That would be the one I mentioned a few minutes
ago. That's a very good one. He's returned with another cracker of a script called The Ukrainian Vampire.
Indeed he has.
Now, I'll talk about this one because I directed this.
Fair enough.
It.
As long as you don't mention Rudolph the Red knowing about reindeer.
No. No, that's best left to not being spoken about. The Ukrainian Vampire was actually a production that I was quite resistant to us producing, simply because it's set in Russia. And as a result of that, I mean, we're Australians, so it's very difficult. I honestly felt it would be difficult for us to effectively realise a Russian location. Having said that, I spoke to Peter about it quite extensively, and he offered an insight into the reasons why he wrote the script, and that was he didn't want us to be putting on thick Russian accents. It wasn't how he'd written it. He had designed it just to be spoken neutrally, because the whole idea, as he said, and I quite agree with this idea, is that people in a country only tend to have accents if foreigners are listening to them.
Yes.
When you're in the country, you tend not to notice the accent that people have. Until it's pointed out to you. And so we worked on that idea in terms of, let's have the actors, and I was very specific with my casting, in terms of making sure that we only had people that could do a slight Russian accent, was have a very slight Russian accent spoken by all the cast members throughout the piece, so that we didn't have this deep accent throughout it, but just the occasional hint. So that way we didn't have this problem of people saying, oh, the Russian accents are unconvincing.
Mm.
But the actual story... Once we'd gotten through that, the actual story was quite fascinating because it deals with an apartment block which is having a series of unexplained, mysterious deaths, and the people are being found dead in the lift in the complex. I think the original title of the story was The Deadly Lift.
That sounds correct, yes.
And that's why we changed it, because it's a really naff title.
Mm.
Whereas
The Ukrainian Vampire sounds very cool.
And it is, because... These people are being stuck in this lift, and they're being drained of their blood. They got little puncture wounds on their neck, and so the KGB, two KGB operatives, are called in at the story to deal with this because the police don't want to have anything to do with it.
I wonder if they're part of the Russian SCPIS.
They could very well be, although there are hints of a certain little nod to continuity, or BTR continuity anyway, at the end of the story, but we won't say much more because you'll just have to listen to it if you want to find out
That's
more.
Right.
But these two KGB operatives basically are investigating the fact that there could be a vampire stalking the building. And suffice it to say, you'll have to listen to find out if there is one.
That's right.
But the other story on that disc is another radical departure for BTR. Written by your good self.
Mm-hmm.
It's entitled The First and the Last.
Yes, that's
and
one.
That
shouldn't be taken to sound bad, by the way.
It's an absolute cracker of a script, given that I haven't read it. I can say that with all confidence, that it is a fantastic script.
I'll give you a 50 quid later.
Thank you. And the reason it's such a radical departure for BTR is it has a cast of one.
That's right.
Now, Vitol, because you wrote it and you directed it over a mammoth 3-hour recording session filled with dogs and children...
And lots of cars.
Could you maybe explain to us a bit about the story and why it was written as a one-hander for a female actress?
Sure. Well, As people may or may not have noticed from the Doctor Who scripts that I tend to write, I like to experiment every now and then. I knew Matthew had told me that that if writers could cut down on the amount of characters in their plays, that would be rather handy with regards to casting, since we are a comparatively small group, and when you're low on the budget, it's not easy to gather casts of thousands, certainly not for a half-hour play, at any rate. So I thought, well, what if I can take this to its absolute extreme? I wasn't seriously considering taking it to the extreme of no cast whatsoever, because I wasn't entirely sure that I could cope with that for a full half-hour story, or indeed tell a story effectively. But I thought, Well, we could probably get away with one. We could do a few cheats to sort of get around it, as in the character may be speaking to other people, but they're off mic or their voices are muffled or whatever. So at the end of the day, technically, it is still just a cast of one, even if a couple of other characters may have quasi-cameos.
It's only one discernible voice.
That's right. So I thought, okay, well, where can I take this? And the notion came to me to explore the life of a charter airline pilot, since if she's flying a charter plane, she'll quite possibly be on her own in the cockpit. So she may have radio communications with others, but by and large, she'll be on her own. She may occasionally be talking to herself, which I'm led to believe is the first sign of madness, but not in radio plays. In radio plays, it's the first sign of plot exposition. And she gradually comes to realize that there's something suspicious going on with her passengers, and this very much the suspicion very much becomes rather more formed when she is, perhaps coincidentally, perhaps not, buzzed by a UFO during the flight, and she starts to wonder precisely what's going on and what connection, if any, exists between the UFO and her passengers. Luckily, casting an alien at various points in the play is also quite easy if the alien doesn't speak English, or indeed doesn't speak, because, hey, that's one less actor you need. But no, generally it was a challenge to try and tell that basic story by using one actor and by occasionally cheating, technically speaking, but trying to make it appear as if no cheating had occurred. Sort of trying to make it as natural as possible.
And I think, I mean, having... the only part of this that I've actually cut together so far is the trailer, because it had to go on the end of the Alien Factor disc, which is now available. And when... That's the first trailer. I mean, I've cut together dozens of trailers and cut together dozens of plays, but this is the first time that a trailer has actually sent a shiver down my spine.
Really?
Because the way... this is news to you as well. I've just realised I haven't actually told you this.
Yes, it is.
Is that you were mentioning the voice of the alien. Now, I, for want of a better term, I play the alien in the piece, but only because there's no dialogue. It's just sort of alien mutterings and a lot of deep breathing. I did the occasional
grunt and groan, as it were.
Exactly. And so I did this... I did a mammoth Foley session for the trailer, where I recorded about half an hour of grunts and groans and deep breathing and little bits of alien voice and chatter and fiddle through with the modulation. And the trailer ends with... she meets this alien in the trailer, and she comes face to face with it, and it's just breathing. But the modulation, a combination of modulation and performance, it's a really spooky voice. Mm. And I think that is one element that I really like about this script, is it's very much a Twilight Zone sort of thriller-type adventure. Mm. It's not like our traditional hard sci-fi or a comedy or a drama or anything. It's actually, it's out there to sort of, to keep you guessing, keep you on the edge of your seat, and the whole scare thing. Mm. And I know for a fact, because I've read your storyline, I haven't read the script, but I've read the storyline, I know for a fact that this story ends with a major twist, oh fuck, ending.
Mm. Actually, I was about to say, because you mentioned twists and turns, that I think it's fairly reasonable to say that this has probably got our strongest twist ending, simply because it's not an episode that just leads to a twist or a twist that's tacked on. It's a case of the tension builds up throughout the play. Mm. You've got a couple of minor twists early on, and then it just keeps building up and up and up until you've got... I suppose the best way to describe the twist would be to say it's the biggest moment of tension in the play.
It's our oh fuck moment.
That's right.
Which, if you remember from the season one documentary, we explained that.
Yes.
The whole idea of, that we wanted to do the occasional story with an oh fuck ending.
Mm-hmm. Without actually including that as dialogue.
No, but that's kind of... The whole thing is designed to be... That's the audience reaction, that when you get to that twist, the first thing you're going to think of is saying is, oh, fuck, I don't believe they just did that.
Now, unless matters have changed, I seem to recall that this is our first Beyond play which has a trailer featuring originally written and recorded material exclusively for the trailer.
Yes. Again, tying into this whole theme of it being a one-hander, when I spoke to you about we need a trailer for volume four for we've got the Ukrainian vampire done, but we need one for First and the Last. We didn't have time to organise the actual physical recording session to get the actual episode recorded. But I suggested, hey, well, why don't we just write, because it's all internal monologue and the whole thing is her talking to herself. What if we did a trailer that was her talking to herself, and it was kind of, it features bits, little bits from the play, but this actual, the trailer is a scene that doesn't actually occur, but it could almost certainly occur off screen, possibly.
It's sort of, it is basically designed to be a scene between scenes from the play, and I believe that parts at the end do tie in with one of the scenes, so if anyone is wanting to put it into the chronology of the play, it's certainly possible to do so. But no, but I thought it would be a good idea to write an original trailer, because if we did the usual method of 90 seconds worth of dialogue clips, it would start to sound possibly a little monotonous and confusing if all the clips are the one person.
Speaking of 90 seconds, I asked you to write me a 90-second script, and what did I get? A 4.5-minute monologue.
Yeah.
So remember, there was a mammoth panic and edit session there where we had to hack this script, which came to 90 seconds in duration, but because of Sharon's performance, it went for 4.5 minutes, and we had to really strip it down to 90 seconds.
Because the one thing we weren't anticipating, which perhaps we should have, was that she gave an intense and anguished and very effective performance, which by its very nature stretched out the material. But it certainly is quite effective, and I think it'll work as a fairly good hook when people hear it on the Alien Factor CD.
Now, the final release of Season 2 is Volume 6, and we'll talk about this very briefly because we're yet to record this, but we'll just give a little 30-second summary of the two stories on it. The first one is one by a new writer to BTR, Morgan Jeffrey, who has written us a script called Nihilate. And I'm just going to leave the title at that because there's a bit of a funny thing with the title, but we're not going to explain it to you now. You'll have to wait until you see the cover art.
That's right.
But the story's called Nihilate, and I'm directing this one, but seems to be the case that when we record these documentaries, we record them just before we do the last two stories of the season. And I'm always due to direct the second last one, but for always the same reason, I have no idea what's happening in it. I've got visions of the Dark Guardian session, and I had no idea what happened in that. Could you fill us in, please, and me especially, on what happens in Nihilate?
I can certainly try. I must confess that at the moment, I'm still in the process of editing the script.
Does sound like the Season 1 documentary.
Well, does it? Goodness. I have received the first draft from Morgan, and it's reading quite well so far. There's just a few little nips and tucks that are required. Essentially, it does seem to be about what would happen if comic book superheroes existed in the real world. So not in the comic book superhero world, where it's generally taken as read that comic book superheroes exist. And in fact, this has been taken to postmodern extremes in such works as Alan Moore's Watchmen, where people almost expect there to be superheroes. This is a case of suddenly a superhero turns up, and of course nobody's expecting this because everyone expects people to be normal and not have superpowers. And so it looks at how other people cope with this newly discovered superhero and how the superhero himself copes with being a newly discovered superhero and copes with his powers and so on. So on one level, it's almost an origin story for a superhero, but on another level, it's more a sort of sense of discovery for all the characters.
Well, certainly sounds exciting. I can't wait to direct it.
Yes. But for a little clue, the title Nihilate refers to a certain scientific something which is a part explanation for the superhero nature of, well, the superhero.
Ah, yes. I see. Now, our final story of the season is an interesting one. It's not so much the return of Natasha Rex, but the discovery of an old episode.
That's right.
Because as you're all probably aware, Natasha Rex was a big comic book superhero here in Australia in the 20th century and sort of came in and out of vogue depending on what was in vogue at the time.
Yes.
And what we were fortunate enough to do was actually dig up an old 1940s episode of the story called Natasha Rex and, what was it, The Train of Doom?
Natasha Rex and The Train of Doom, that's correct.
And I think it's going to be an interesting story because in terms of, I mean, it's an old-time radio production.
Yes.
That I've got to do a bit of remastering on, so, but I mean, given that my remastering techniques are limited, it's not going to sound terribly good. But it's a nice way, I think, to show people what Natasha X was like in her 1940s heyday.
That's right. I hope it doesn't prove too alienating, because, as I'm sure everyone is aware, when we revived Natasha X a couple of years ago, we were instrumental in casting Kelly Holland in the role. However, because this was not originally a BTR production, and in fact dates from around the 1940s, which I think it's safe to say several decades before Kelly was born, she won't be featuring in the title role. But I've had a bit of a listen to it, and I have to say the actor who was used in the 1940s was very good, and I think she'll make a worthy substitute.
Well, I think it's more to say that Kelly was the substitute for, because,
well, thing, yes,
it's
yes.
Kind of, Natasha X is very much like James Bond. There's been so many different people that have played Natasha, and it just happens that the one we've cast is Kelly.
That's
and
right.
So when it became looking likely that it would be unlikely that we'd be able to record another one with Kelly because of actor unavailability, we sort of thought, well, we wanted to do another Natasha release. And then when we stumbled across this this old episode from the 1940s, The Train of Doom, we thought, hey, let's release this, because it's out of copyright. It's over, I think, because it's over 50 years old.
That's right.
So it's in the public domain.
So it saves
domain.
Us a little money as
it
well.
It does indeed, yes. In much the same way that a lot of the Sherlock Holmes, I think, the scripts are now in the public domain.
Quite possibly, yeah.
So I think this will be interesting for people to have a listen to how Natasha X was sort of 60 years ago, and how we've sort of, and then compare that to the ones we've done, and show how we've reinterpreted the character for the 21st century.
But although I must say, one thing I found fascinating was that your narrator sounds remarkably similar to the narrator they used in the 1940s. Now, I know you studied it briefly, but I have to say, kudos to you. You did a very good job of recreating it.
Well, I think it's just it's such a standard role.
That is true.
I mean, the narrator from the 1940s sounds a lot more pompous.
Yeah.
And,
just imagine any old game show host, really.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, my inspiration was Pete Smith.
Mm.
And for anyone who's Australian, you'll know exactly who I'm talking about. So
yes.
My inspiration for the role of the narrator was Pete Smith. And, I mean, Pete Smith's been in the game show narration business for donkey's years, so it's more than likely that his style developed from the radio announcers of the 1940s.
That's right.
And I know that, the Doctor Who Big Finish release, Storm Warning, had a very similar narrator on that. And when I heard that, I thought, that was just as we were coming into doing Natasha X back in 2001. And so I heard that and sort of took a bit of that, a bit of Pete Smith, and then a bit of my own interpretation.
Yeah.
And so when we heard The Train of Doom, I was astounded. I thought, oh my goodness, that's quite freaky.
Yeah.
How similar it was. But anyway, that's season 2 of Beyond Traditional Recognition in a nutshell, coming out this year. Volume 1, which is out now, January, The Alien Factor, or Volume 4, I should say.
Yes.
Volume 5, which is The Ukrainian Vampire and the First and the Last, out in May is right. And then in September, we have Volume 6, which is Nihilate, and the OTR classic, Natasha X and the Train of Doom. So make sure you keep an eye out on our website for announcements and release dates and all that sort of stuff about as we get closer to releasing those. Well, Vito, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you,
everyone, for listening. We hope that you enjoy the ride with Season 2 of Beyond Traditional Recognition.
Yes, indeed.